Hi, my name is Janet Fertessi, and I'm an assistant professor in the sociology department at Princeton. Most of my research is actually with NASA and its robotic spacecraft team, so I've been working for the last decade or so. But I also do work in human-computer interaction and computer-supported cooperative work, and I'm an advisory board member on the Data and Society Research Council in New York. So I have a real interest in internet safety, internet privacy, and kinds of technical issues around the relationship between technology and society.
Hi, I'm Jen Rexford. I'm a professor and chair of computer science at Princeton, and my research area is computer networking. I'm particularly interested in the performance, security, and reliability of the infrastructure underlying the internet. And recently, I've been thinking a lot about how to make that infrastructure more programmable to make it easier to innovate in making networks better, performant, more secure, and more reliable.
Excellent. So, Jen, do you want to just start us off? And what do you think are the key issues in terms of how liberty can survive the digital age?
So it's obviously a very broad topic. And I think one thing you and I can both bring to that discussion is that we can talk a lot about the content that people read and how that affects the lens through which they see debates that take place, or even if they're allowed to speak freely in the first place. But I think an area we might be able to bring a little light is looking at the infrastructure itself and how that affects the experience people have in using the internet as a vehicle for communication and getting information. So I mentioned earlier, I'm really interested in the infrastructure underlying the internet. And in that context, I've done some work in the Federal Communication Commission's Open Internet Order and Open Internet Advisory Committee. And there we looked a lot at mobile broadband in particular, which is becoming increasingly the dominant way people access the internet. They're on their mobile phones, accessing cellular networks or Wi-Fi networks. And in fact, for people in the developing world or lower income communities in the U.S., it often is the only access that people have to the internet. So the way that it shapes whether and what they can access is a really important part of the conversation. And what's interesting here is, you know, governments and nation states obviously are who we normally think of when we talk about liberty issues. But here corporations play a really significant role in shaping the user experience. So if you just look at the major players in the mobile broadband ecosystem in the U.S., there's very, very little competition, right? There's basically two or three dominant smartphone vendors. There's two dominant operating systems, Google Android and Apple iOS. There's only four mobile broadband providers of any significance, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile. There are only a few equipment vendors that sell to those companies as well. And sure, there's bazillion applications, but even if you look at the application space, about half of the revenue for mobile applications come from just 25 software developers like Disney, Zynga.
25% come from the same application provider?
So half of the revenue for mobile broadband applications come from just 25 software developers.
And which companies are those?
These are like Disney and Zynga are being two prominent examples. So basically, they're mostly game and entertainment applications. I mean, the bottom line is the vast majority of apps don't have any market at all. Most make less than $500 a month. You know, so this idea that we have a bunch of people sitting in their basements creating apps and having them be widely used and go viral just largely isn't true. There's a small number of apps, you know, we mostly use. And so they really, again, become a big part of the lens through which we access information. And certainly when we talk about fake news and filter bubbles, people getting their news from Facebook and Twitter, that's a good example of that, where so many people are having their experience curated through applications that are written by commercial entities that are acting under their own interest, trying to keep users around, trying to sell advertising and so on. So throughout each of those things, you know, the smartphones themselves, the network infrastructure that connects them to the internet, and the applications that run on them, we have a very, very small number of parties. And even there are only two to four big players in many of those categories, and often the same big players. I mean, Google, as an example, is a major application developer as well as a smartphone operating system developer. Apple obviously creates the phone and the operating system and curates the app store. And so, again, you have a relatively small number of players curating our experiences for us.
Right, and relatively limited ecosystems and environments that those apps are working in.
Exactly, and a big barrier to entry for new players. So, just to give an example, the App Store. If you take Apple as an example, they control that you can't really install a new application on your phone without going through the App Store. They screen the applications. They take a 30% cut on the revenue, and they determine where your application is placed in terms of, you know, how does someone find it in the first place? Is it promoted? Is it listed in the right category? And so you take all of those restrictions, it can be very difficult for someone creating a new app to really have a way to ramp up and actually get significant adoption. And that's compounded when you look at the small number of application developers that already dominate the space. So how do you compete with Facebook or Disney,
right,
for example, if you have a new app?
So is this one of the big concerns of something like the Open Internet Consortium at the FCC?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one big challenge is that when we normally think about regulation, you know, you think about the FCC, you think about regulating carriers, I mean, carriers are a small piece of the puzzle here. I mean, most of the companies I just mentioned are Apple, Google, Disney, and so on. They're not subject to regulation by the FCC because they're not a carrier. When we used to think about telephony and telephones, you definitely think, okay, it's AT&T and Sprint and so on that we're talking about. But in the internet space, the person who provides the network infrastructure is relatively small portion of the puzzle. Not to say that we shouldn't be concerned about them, but it's very hard to have a coherent conversation about regulation or even sort of self-imposed regulation, if you will, because the parties involved are not even in the same business category.
Yeah, they're in completely different realms. Well, and are you seeing any changes because of this kind of collapse of the network provider and the content provider? I mean, some of the stuff that's going on and the ways that they the networks that provide the infrastructure for access are also starting to be the ones that provide content that's being accessed on those same lines. Is that something that's affecting this kind of question of the open internet or the question of which players have barriers to entry and which ones don't?
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you look at what the carriers do control, I mean, they can sometimes make it that your phone can't access another carrier's network. They can have restrictions on what applications you can run. One particular case we looked at in the working group I was in was when FaceTime originally came out, the sort of video chat service came out on mobile phones, AT&T disallowed it for being used on its network for anyone that wasn't in a particular billing plan that billed based on usage. And that's something, you know, a carrier can do. And in the end, they, you know, based on some of the work in our committee, relaxed some of those restrictions. But it's a perfect example where a new entrant, you know, in this case, Apple, so it's not necessarily someone who's struggling to compete in the marketplace. But if you imagine a smaller party that doesn't have the resources to combat those kind of restrictions, that can be a big deal. And in particular, in a lot of countries that have weaker restrictions on openness, there's a lot of interest in so-called two-sided pricing, where a content provider and a carrier work together to offer content that isn't subject to a usage cap. A good example in Europe, in Asia in particular, Facebook and Spotify, you know, so the social networking application and music application, they want their users on all the time. They want their users being able to stream, video content or music. And so they'll go into an agreement with a carrier saying, well, you're subject to usage caps if you use anything else. But if you're using Facebook, it's going to be free.
Right.
And so that's a perfect example where, again, there's one particular lens into seeing the content that informs whether our populace is educated and informed to make informed choice about the news, politics, policy, and so on. And if it becomes, it's free to get Facebook, but you have to pay for NPR, you know, you're living in a very different environment than if all content is available with the same kind of charging mechanism. So that's another example where I think the economic incentives of the carriers and the content providers and their desire to collaborate to make that lock into the user even stronger really comes into play.
Right. It has a lot of overtones of the free basics kind of provision, right?
Exactly.
What are the other sorts of issues that we should be concerned about when it comes to the open internet, and especially thinking about the role of companies and corporations in the sort of economic space?
Well, I think the thing I mentioned earlier, where many of these companies are not subject to the same regulatory regime, it makes it very hard for there to be any kind of coherence. I think that's one challenge, and the fact that they increasingly play in multiple kinds of markets, where there can be dominance not just in the phone but in the access or in the apps. I think those are the two big issues. And I think if you think about something like Facebook and the recent election in the U.S., the idea that there can be a very strong economic incentive to present people the information that they like because it keeps them on the site longer. And so we should definitely be concerned that the economic incentives that drive the content that we see may work very much against us having a culture with a common notion of even what's going on. I think that's not just about the infrastructure itself, but it is about the economics that drives the choices of what people do on that infrastructure. I know that's something you've thought a lot about, too. I mean, it's not just about how the content's delivered or who can access it or how quickly or how cheaply, but also about one's own data. And I think these companies also are collecting a profound amount of information about us. And this is an area I know you've thought a lot about. I'm curious, how do you think about the role of economic incentives in the people's data that is actually collected by many of the same companies?
Well, it's actually something I think about a lot, and I'm very concerned about it. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the post-Web 2.0 world has been a sort of economization of data as a primary currency that's fueling and supporting what seems to be a sort of relatively open internet. Many of these applications are free or appear to be free, but actually the payment is through this dragnet kind of collection of personal surveillance, of personal data. And that's not always a trade-off I think people are willing to make. I mean, there's certainly, I've encountered the attitude of, well, what do I really have to hide? But for anyone that has family members that have ever been in a autocratic regime or in a situation of regime change really quickly, they'll note that data or information that's captured under one context can suddenly have a very different valence when the context shifts. So that's something I'm very concerned about, thinking about this from a long view kind of perspective of where this data is being collected, who it's being collected by, and where it's going, to what uses it might eventually be put. The difficulty I have also is that within this economic framework where the data is, personal data is fueling the internet economy, there is a need to collect ever more of it. To put it into conversation with other forms of personal data, which can really easily be de-identifying, or can be very, very easily be de-identified, and make it very clear, like exactly which individuals are being surveilled or being followed. And so, this question of the economization of data is not just a question of then producing these algorithmic online environments that only show you the things you want to see, which is problematic for the way we conceptualize democracy in the agora. But it's also a question of maintaining a record in a place that you don't have any control over. So this is actually one of the things I'd like to push for, is that we start thinking about what data is being collected, by whom, by which actors, and where it's being kept, and whether or not that's something we have any control over. And in many cases, these companies will say, well, don't worry about it. It's just sort of happening in the background. Everything's encrypted on our end. We won't give it away to anyone, nefarious. But certainly the fact that data is changing hands with large-scale advertising companies or with data sniffers or with government agencies is something that should give every internet user pause.
So I think another factor there is people have a sense that they're anonymous when they're browsing. They may know when they're connected to Facebook, they're logged in. Of course, Facebook has some notion of their identity, but they may view that their other browsing habits are not available. And I think that there's just a lack of awareness of what's technically possible in terms of connecting multiple different kinds of data together based on common information that might be in the two different data sets. So that sort of informs, I think, a certain naivete that people think that they're anonymous when they're not.
Sure. I mean, it's not just what you give to Facebook. It's also that Facebook puts cookies in your browser that checks out what you're doing elsewhere. So that pair of shoes you looked at, or the diapers you bought online, are going to follow you around for the next 3 years, because some cookie embedded in your browser is reported back to Facebook or Google or some other company that you're the kind of user who's going to want to see this sort of a product. So it can very easily put you into particular kinds of boxes. Now, if that's for marketing purposes, okay, fine. But if that's for other kinds of purposes, maybe that's not so fine.
So I have a funny anecdote about that. At Christmas last year, we saw three boxes under the tree, one for me, one for my partner, and one for my mother, that were the same shape. We're like, huh, that's kind of curious. Ends up we all three bought the same coffee mug, the exact same coffee mug. And presumably what happened there is one of us bought it, and then I remember seeing it in my Facebook feed in an ad and thinking, oh, that's kind of cute. I bet my partner would like that. Well, ends up that she had just bought it for me. So so now we have three mugs. What are we going to do with them? I don't know.
Right, exactly. Well, and I've also heard stories of people who are like about to propose to their significant other, and of course they're looking for, rings online, and then the ad trail gives them away, or, trying to figure out how to hide that from the other people in their lives. But I think actually one of the things that's tricky is that when we think about our use of social media platforms or the use of these corporate platforms, we often think about the relationship between us and our friends that we're communicating with. So when I think what I want to put on Facebook, I think, like, what do I want my mother to see? Or what do I want my students to see? Or my husband or whatever. But But why aren't we thinking, what do I want Facebook to see? What do I want Facebook to know? And how do I want that to connect with all these other pieces of information I've already given Facebook about me, you know, based on my browsing habits and based on, you know, what else I've clicked on their site? Because all of those little pieces of information are being gathered in that database. So I think one of the things, when we think about the infrastructure that underlies the internet, and when we think about the economics that inform that infrastructure, what we need to be asking ourselves is, if we've economized data in this way, are we comfortable with how and where it's being kept? Are we comfortable with how and where it's being collected? And if you're not, what power do you have to do something about it?
So let's suppose you decide that we shouldn't be comfortable, that there's a way the user should have a way to decide how much data they're willing to let go of, and perhaps for what compensation. I mean, who can be in charge of regulating that sort of thing or dictating that sort of thing?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, it's really up to the user, and it's often up to the user to navigate these absolutely enormous and unwieldy privacy policies that change all the time, that you're just supposed to click through and accept, otherwise you can't use the product. So there's actually very limited space for dissent, and it's one of the things that I find really troublesome. Now, that said, there are companies and organizations and groups that are trying to build alternatives, right? I think, you know, Diaspora several years ago was the alternative to Facebook. It was quite an interesting model. It didn't take off anywhere near the same way Facebook did. But what it tried to do was a proof of concept. You could have a social network that was distributed across many, many different servers. I think some of the stuff that BitTorrent is now doing with their Resilio Sync product, right, which is basically like a Dropbox, except what it does is it breaks your files up and distributes them all over a network. So there's no single place where your files are. And that's, you know, in opposition to Dropbox, who will keep your stuff on Dropbox's servers, and that belongs to them as much as it belongs to you. So these are kinds of technical and in some cases social solutions to some of these problems, which are to say maybe embrace different funding models, embrace different kinds of architectures for what the infrastructure of the internet could be, what the economics that would underlie this business or this organization or this nonprofit could be that are associated with this technology. So I find those examples really exciting. They don't always take off at incredible scale, but what they at least try to do is trouble this notion that the only way to make money on the internet or have a company is to do it by collecting vast amounts of data and to put users' privacy at risk. And that the only way to, you know, create these technologies is along these already well-trodden lines. And instead to say, well, actually, if we thought about data and where users' data is kept and whether or not they have control over that as one of our primary values in designing a system, we might end up designing something quite different.
That's really interesting. I mean, in my world, thinking about the underlying, you know, physical infrastructure of the internet, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of naivete that, oh, the data that we send over the internet's encrypted. We're fine. Looking at the analog of yours, the data that's being stored on the sending and receiving end is encrypted is fine, but there's so much that's revealed, and just knowing who's talking to who and when, and even how big the communication is, there's a lot of techniques like web fingerprinting, where even if you just know how many bytes I download from a particular IP address, you might know immediately what website I'm going to, and even which page on that website I'm currently looking at. So it's really, really interesting opportunities to de-anonymize the data, even if it appears to be encrypted. And also, if you think about the internet itself, it's sort of a network of networks. So if you try to think of the internet or something, you know, violating your privacy, it's not even clear what that means. I mean, your traffic between two locations in the U.S. may leave the U.S. and come back, or vice versa, more likely for other countries. Their traffic can often go through the U.S. inadvertently from their perspective. And so we've been doing some studies that there are many countries who can't communicate without their traffic going through the U.S. Yeah. Even inside the country, the traffic may leave the country and come back in. And so all of a sudden, they're subject to whatever surveillance activities that that other third country might do to their data.
Yeah, and one of the maps I show in my class is on technology and society is that, you know, the lines of the internet actually is a series of tubes, and there's now these maps you can get of where the pipes for the internet go under the ocean, and you can see the line that was being built between Brazil and Portugal, right, as a way of trying to bypass having internet traffic go through the United States, and that a lot of this is based on old classic colonial ties. It's laid down along really historic lines of relationships between countries. But it's also, you know, some of this has come into light with the Snowden revelations that, you know, countries like Brazil were like, we don't want any of our traffic going through the U.S. So we're going to reach to another country that we have this longstanding historic relationship with to try to subvert that. But again, paying attention to where that data goes, I think, can surface some really unusual surprises.
Exactly.
Yeah. I will say, actually, you know, one other thing that I've been thinking about is it's not just about encryption. It really sometimes is just about data ownership. So one of the things I've been experimenting with is, what does it take to opt out? What does it take to actually not use these systems? And it turns out it takes a lot. So I've been a conscientious objector to Google since 2012 when they changed their privacy policy so that they could now combine data on individuals from across their services. And I thought that's actually problematic. First of all, it's problematic sociologically because people behave differently in different contexts and I should have the right to do that. But also it's problematic because it pinpoints individual users, and we know that the more data streams you bring together, the easier it is to de-anonymize, right, to identify individuals. So I got off the system, and I will say, like, for the last, I guess it's been 5 years now, it's very difficult to avoid Google products and services. It's very hard to do. You know, in another instance, I tried to, you know, curtail or manage shopping habits online or in person using credit cards so that I wouldn't be traced about particular sets of purchases. That's also very hard to do. You end up having to rely on a cash economy. You end up having to, shop in strange places, get things sent to strange places, use alternative addresses, like you look like a criminal.
Yeah, I was about to say, you might set off, ironically, more surveillance.
Exactly. And recently I've been experimenting with hacking mobile phones and putting on alternative operating systems, ones that haven't necessarily, you know, traveled very far. So things like Sailfish or Firefox OS, or I use an old Nokia N9, which I love because it talks to the Nokia store and it doesn't exist anymore. Like, you can't buy anything from it. It's great. And I remember, you know, tweeting online that I managed to, you know, put these operating systems on the phone, and someone was like, well, you can't use Firefox mobile OS because it's not secure. I mean, they're not keeping it up to date anymore. So things aren't going to be, you know, encrypted. It's going to be insecure. And my answer to that was, actually, I don't care about that. The experiment was about, can I have control over where this data is going? And if it's trying to talk to a series of servers that belong to a company that's no longer supporting that anymore, then I don't have to be so worried about Firefox collecting this data as opposed to somebody else sniffing it up and figuring it out. So it felt to me like I had some control because I'd sort of managed to say to this phone, I want you to talk to this organization or this company and not that one. And that to me was enough. Now, the difficulty is, of course, that shouldn't have to be a trade-off. It was useful for me to be able to say, oh, actually, the thing I care about is, do I own this data? Do I run my own local instance of a shared folder? Do I run my own operating system? Do I get to keep my data somewhere where I have ownership over it? That shouldn't be different from, is this secure? Unfortunately, I think it still is, largely because so much of this is obscured by this very large word of privacy, and that it's very hard to disambiguate the different elements of privacy, and that maybe data ownership is one of them, a distinct stream that we should support. But what I'd like to see in future is more people try to tackle this problem of, where is your data? Do you know where it's going? Do you get to decide who to give it to? And do you get to decide who doesn't get it? As we start to attack that as a problem, can we also loop in what we know about regulation, about safety and security, about encryption? Can we bring those things to the fore and allow people to make their own decisions?
Yeah, there's interesting tensions there in the sort of so-called Internet of Things, right, where there are a lot of devices Internet in people's homes now that are using operating systems that might not be upgraded. You buy a picture frame, wireless picture frame, the company goes out of business, the code was never written all that well to begin with, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a great vector for launching attacks on other people, but also in compromising one's own privacy. So we're definitely entering a fairly scary era where there's going to be a lot of naive users installing tons of unprotected devices in their homes, many of which have access not only to their digital data, but even physical information. I mean, I just heard a speaker earlier today talking about how just the vibrations of your floor, if you have building sensors to try to detect structural integrity of your building, can reveal where you are in the building and even which person you are, because the gait of different people is different, what your emotional state is, what your heart rate is. Many of these things are actually measurable just from the environmental sensors around us, which have really interesting privacy implications, because those sensors are there for an entirely different purpose, not even the picture frame I voluntarily chose to install.
Yeah. When I think about these examples and I think about how these Internet of Things technologies have invaded the home, there's sort of been a longstanding series of debates about how best to do that in human-computer interaction. And one of my favorite examples of a kind of juxtaposition to the normal way of doing things is a system that was built by colleagues at Cornell and at Goldsmiths, where they went into someone's home and they outfitted it with a series of sensors. But it wasn't like cameras to record everything or like a Nest that could tell if you were home or not and would change the temperature. It was stuff like a little sensor in a couch that the husband and wife typically sat on at the end of the day to talk about their day and decompress and have a cup of tea. So if they sat on that frequently, then you'd know that things were sort of humming along in the normal rhythm of the home. But if for a while they didn't sit on the couch and have that cup of tea every day, you knew probably maybe things were starting to go a bit awry. And so the kind of responses that the home would then give to its users came in form of horoscopes. So it wasn't like, we know you use this much water at this much time and you were home and then you weren't home and then your son came home and your dog walked to the room. It was more things like, you should consider taking some time to relax and smell the roses, right? And what I like about that
I can just imagine seeing ads for divorce lawyers and, you know.
Absolutely. Well, under the current framework, it would totally be that. Like, looks like you need a divorce lawyer, as opposed to, you know, the home saying, gee, maybe you should smell the roses a little more. Have you been for a walk lately? And those kinds of things. Like, it's not as creepy. It doesn't make you feel like your home has surveilled you and knows everything about you and has uploaded all this very specific data to Google, but instead was kind of a little bit more playful and a little more imaginative and allowed the people in the home to interact with the technology differently. So I like that example because, you know, it's a bit crazy and it's a bit out there, but when you start thinking about it, you're like, well, why can't we build things like that? Like, why did we have to build them this other way?
So
not entirely clear.
But we think about the topic at the beginning about liberty and can liberty survive the digital age? I'm curious your thoughts on how this all ties back. I mean, in the things I was talking about, you know, the people having this highly curated view of the internet and the content on it, clearly it means we aren't a single populace. I mean, we never have been, but it's even more fragmented because the content we see is so different than when we all had three TV stations and watched the news every night. I'm curious in the context of the user data and the access that companies and perhaps governments have to that data, how do you see that affecting our ability to have democracy?
Well, I'm going to turn this question back on you in a minute, too. So I would say in a few ways. One is that the economic incentives that underlie the way that content is currently being presented to users, I think, clearly undermines the notion of civic debate or the agora, right, which was supposed to animate politics in a democracy. And when you think back to the old, like, Athenian definition of what the democracy was, like, you gathered in the public square in the agora and had active discussions about topics with people that didn't believe the same things as you, and that exposure to different points of view was very important. Unfortunately, in an environment where content is created based on, like, collected data about a user and an algorithmic determination of what's going to make that user happy to stay on your site, you're going to see more and more fragmenting and less opportunity for different sides to actually have a conversation. So that would be one thing. But another thing that I'm really concerned about has to do with choice. And that has to do with, have we given users an opportunity to make decisions, active decisions about which kinds of technologies they want to bring into their homes and which kinds of digital traces they want to leave and which companies they want to leave those traces with and which ones they don't? And unfortunately, as we move towards these sort of ever larger companies shaping the kinds of things that we see and do online, whether it's Google or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, we have an increasing reliance upon those companies to be the shepherds of our data traces and to be the providers of our services. And that looks to me like really limiting our technological choices and possibilities. And I find that to be a real problem. There's the additional issue of traceability and the, you know, what happens to these traces after the fact. And there's any number of totally paranoid stories I could tell you about World War II where, you know, certain sets of data were collected under very happy and, you know, patriotic reasons then were nefariously turned to bad purposes. But I think these questions about, like, do we as consumers and users actually get the chance to choose? To make informed decisions and to provide alternatives? Or are we just being presented with a kind of notion that this is the inexorable path of progress and you're either with us or you're a Luddite? And I fear that it's going to be the alternative instead of the former, which would really allow us to be creative and to be thoughtful in our choices. But I'll turn that over to you then and ask how you see this intersecting with how liberty can survive the digital age.
So I think many of the same issues you mentioned, I mean, I think if you go one step lower in the infrastructure, you run into the same issues, a small number of companies controlling the infrastructure and curating the experience. You add on top of it the kind of user data that they can bring to curate it in a much more personalized way. And I think it's an even stronger point. I'll just add one thing that I think the fact that the network is made up of a bunch of different nation states as well as different commercial entities. But I think the sort of nation state boundaries are particularly interesting. And you hinted at this already, and we're talking about countries wanting to avoid going through the United States. But the companies and the countries that control the infrastructure also get to see an awful lot of traffic, first of all, which gives them a lot of intelligence as well as commercial visibility into what might be going on in other regions of the world. And also people that control the infrastructure have an opportunity to change how traffic flows through the network in ways that might allow that traffic to go through parts of the world where they can more freely perform surveillance. So I think the idea that somehow the traffic is just there and if it happens to go through you, you get to take a look at it, it's also a fairly naive viewpoint because you can often control whether the traffic goes through you. And we've seen a number of incidents, many of them accidents, but increasingly we see evidence of them being done purposefully where traffic that would normally not go through Iceland or not go through China or not go through Pakistan or not go through the U.S. Does so because someone configured the underlying network equipment in a way to change the path that the rest of the internet uses to get there. And so I think the idea that there can be sort of active attacks to bring the data to where it can be monitored rather than bring a monitor to the data is another thing to think about. And again, it's very easy to overlook because we like to think of the internet as a single infrastructure, but it's anything but.
Yeah, it's actually really the splinter net notion, I think, is actually very powerful. We used to talk about the many internet. I mean, one thing that's also related to that is that in thinking about where your traffic goes or where the traffic could be intercepted, it's important as a user to keep the larger geopolitical moments in mind, like which countries are allies. You know, it might be that this traffic all goes through England, but I know that England and America have a reciprocal agreement so that even if it goes exclusively through there, it's something that might be shared with America or something to that extent. I thought about this also in the corporate domain, right, that I will use a variety of different tools that belong to different companies. I might be one of the only people left in the world who still use AIM.
Oh, my goodness.
AOL and Messenger. But that's because, you know, I know that AOL is, they're not friends with Google and they're not friends with Facebook. And so any chat that I have on an AOL service is going to stay totally separate from whatever I do on Bing or whatever I do on, you know, something that touches a Facebook server or a Google sniffer. So you have to think also about which companies are friends with each other, who has data sharing agreements with each other, who's connected to a third party data manager or advertising company, who might be a connector point between those companies. The same way that you would think about that geopolitically is who would connect between different countries.
Yeah, in some of our recent work, we've been looking at Tor, the onion router that a lot of people use, and dissidents and others for accessing the internet anonymously. And there, if you're able to see the connection from the user to the Tor node that it connects with, and then also later another Tor node's connection to the server you're ultimately really trying to communicate with, those look like two very different pieces of communication. So you think, okay, you're fine. And it's encrypted anyway, so even if someone's looking at both locations, you're fine. But not really true, because it's often the case that a single company or set of companies that are subject to a single set of laws might be collectively in both locations and able to combine the data together. And if you consider that, well, gee, the timing of exactly how much data is sent and when, you know, it's going to be common at those two locations. And maybe even the amount of data may be indicative of what kind of content you're downloading. And all of a sudden, there's all sorts of ways to really triangulate all that information together to figure out exactly who's accessing what content. And it's even worse than if you were just accessing it directly because you think you're safe. And in fact, you're anything but. It's quite clear what site you're accessing. And particularly if you're in a dictatorial regime, you're now really subject to some pretty big problems because of that. But even if you're not, you may arouse suspicion in areas that weren't really warranted before.
Yeah, so I guess one question that I would have about this is then what can the individual user do? Like, how is it that individuals should get educated about this as a problem? I mean, I use Tor all the time. What can I do about that as an issue? Is this something that has to be written into, you know, updated privacy and user agreements, or is this something that users can take matters into their own hands? Is this something that has to happen through regulatory change, or how can you see these these problems being addressed, especially by the individual.
Yeah, I think it's very challenging. I mean, one thing we've looked at, some of the students in my class this past semester looked at, was extensions to your browser that would report to you, you know, what networks or what countries your traffic is going to. And maybe even before you decide to do the download, hey, this is the path I think you're going to take. You know, the only thing revealed so far is you were curious what path it would be. You know, but if you go further, you're about to let anyone on that path know what content you're downloading. Now, you know, a lot of users won't care, as a tremendous usability challenges there. People don't want to be inspecting every second. But if they start to now put in preferences to say, well, gee, if the traffic is going to go through the U.S., I'd rather not. Right. That at least gives people the opportunity to make policy-based decisions. The second thing that we've been working on is letting people route around a country they don't want to go through. Maybe the path their own internet service provider would pick would go through, let's say, the U.S. But if we let them bounce their traffic off of somebody else, then maybe maybe the path they take to that somebody else doesn't go through the U.S., and the path that somebody else takes also doesn't go through the U.S. It's going to be a little less performant because you're going a little bit out of your way. But if your alternative is to go through a country or a company you really don't want your traffic to go through, it might be worth it. And so, again, we're trying to automate choice there, where a user can say, I don't want to go through these three companies in these two countries, and we'll tell their browser extension, hey, you know, go this way through this intermediate point, and then we can avoid your going, you know, through the places you don't want to go. So that's going to be a savvy user, you know, or a carrier acting on behalf of a set of users who have a common set of concerns like that. But I think we can start to at least, you know, route around the, or at least make people aware where their traffic is going and help them route around it, or provide bundled service offerings that at least avoid particular countries or companies of shared concern.
Yeah, I really like that, because it shows that when you put different values at the center of your design practice, you can actually end up with really exciting and really useful technologies for different communities. I mean, if you think about network properties and principles only in terms of efficiency and, you know, least number of, you know, milliseconds of cable traveled, right? Then you're going to end up with a very different answer than if you put at the center, I actually want to manage where my data goes.
Yeah, it's interesting, because the internet really was designed to enable innovation and choice, right? By putting programmable computers in the driver's seat at the edge of the internet, we somehow made it possible for a tremendous amount of innovation and applications and choice at that level. But ironically, very little choice in terms of how your application leverages the network underneath. And that's the piece we're trying to attack, is can we make the network more flexible so we can expose a certain level of user choice there as well, now that economic and nation state issues play such a big role in how traffic flows.
Oh, I really like that as an idea. It reminds me of one of my favorite browser plugins, which is Lightbeam. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm not, no.
Oh, it's really great. It allows you to see where all the data sniffers are attached to any site you go to, but it will show you network connections between them. So instead of looking like geopolitically, it will look at like which kinds of bots or sniffers or trackers you're going to be connected to. So if you load up something like Facebook, it will give you a little picture of Facebook, but then it will also show you all the different ad managers and, you know, different assorted third-party things that get pinged with Facebook. And depending on how many sites you start to load, you'll see where the connection points are, where the third-party connection points are between them. And I think it also it's a really useful way of visually informing a user. If you want to make strategic decisions about how and where your data goes, and you're thinking not just geopolitically but also in terms of the corporate landscape, then here's the actors. Here are the key actors that you're going to want to avoid, or here's the ones that you're going to want to circumvent in some way.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it seems like getting just... Right. To pop up a level, then it seems like having users be informed by having extensions to the interfaces they use to have them be aware of where their traffic goes or what companies their traffic's going through, or who do those companies cooperate with, so that there's an informed decision. So you don't even just want them to think about it at the level of individual institutions, but also what the relationships are between them. So it's a whole level of making users informed about what's happening to their traffic or their data right now. And to make people more aware of the kinds of things that could happen down the road if that information of their accesses or their data are revealed. And then having underlying infrastructure that can at least, where possible, make it possible for individual users or groups of users to affect change in how their traffic is stored or used or travels.
Right. And I would also to pop up and get back to some of the issues you started off with, to think about how, like, this isn't just a problem for the individual user, but it's also something that's going to require collaboration between different kinds of agencies on a scale that we haven't really seen before. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, the organizations that provide content and service belong to such different industries that they're regulated by entirely different organizations in the United States. And then to think about how and where those things travel internationally, there does need to be regulatory or sort of top-down kind of constraints and intervention in this space as well to protect users. But there's going to need to be some kind of change that will enable that sort of cross-agency and cross-regulatory space to take place.
Yeah, one baby step in that direction, and I think we've seen in the last several years, an increase in the number of U.S. government agencies that have a CTO, you know, a chief technical officer kind of role, the FCC, the FTC. I mean, the ones that are more related to computing and communication, that's been happening. But, of course, this needs to be much broader. You know, the Department of Agriculture probably needs a CTO also, and because technology is going to play a big role in pretty much every aspect of government. And so I think, I mean, obviously it's a lot to do to get people with a computer science or IT or communications background in positions where they can actually be a resource to a group of people that might not otherwise be able to think about these issues just because of the technical details involved in them.
Yeah. Well, and also I think it's another one of the reasons why we need to make sure that our computer science graduates are also well versed in issues such as, you know, how governments work, how regulatory structures work, international politics. These are not just, you know, satisfying a breadth requirement, but they're actually the background to the environment in which they may eventually work.
Exactly. And also, I think, to appreciate the technical decisions they make have these very far-reaching implications, and not every application is really for a Silicon Valley 20-year-old, but also for a much broader user community, both within the country and beyond. So it's, I think getting them to take the long view of what the implications are of the choices they make is critical.
Well, I'm glad we're on the same page. This is going to be a really exciting discussion in Berlin.
Excellent. It's been fun chatting with you.
Yeah, it's been great. Have a good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
You bet.
You've been listening to WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.